Senators Ellis Donnelly and Chair Taylor, and just off record, before we started the meeting, we were informally discussing 163. Mr. Noy, would you like to give some brief explanation on that?
Mr. Senator Taylor, my name's Steve Noy. I'm a director of the Alaska Trust Company. I also lobby for the Alaska Trust Company. Senate Bill 163 are some corrections to current Alaska law, and most of those corrections have been taken from the Uniform Trust Act. They deal with modification and termination of trusts, but the article that seems to be of the largest concern is duty to inform the beneficiaries. The Uniform Act also addresses that. And under one section, it states that the result of this limitation is that the information need not be furnished to beneficiaries with remote remainder interest. And that is why the term current beneficiaries was used for those beneficiaries that are immediately to receive the funds, and remote remainder interest or any people that may get it in the future, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. One of the other problems with the that's concerned with the duty to inform is if you have minors that are informed, the court could require the trust to pay for a guardian ad litem to represent the interest of those future generations for up to 18 or 21 years, whatever the age of majority was in that state or in our state, where it would be a cost to the trust that wouldn't necessarily be necessary if it's just informing the current beneficiaries.
I know Senator Donnelly had questions, so I wanted to turn it over to Senator Donnelly to clarify his concerns.
Well, I just disagree with the direction the whole concept's going, Mr. Chairman, that we're going to not relieve the requirement to notify beneficiaries, future beneficiaries of trust. I think they deserve to be in the notification loop. If they're not specifically written out, it may be appropriate for a court to have a guardian ad litem represent their interests. I just disagree where this concept's going. I don't think it's the right thing to do.
Senator Donnelly, through the chair, how do they go about notifying people that haven't been born yet? I mean, this is where the crux comes in of trying to come up with a practical way of doing the notification.
This is a change to existing law. Existing law has been like this for quite a while, right? When was the last time that was changed?
It hasn't been, but when you adopted the Alaska Trust Act, which allowed trust in perpetuity, it changed the time frame for what the trust could, you know, the duration of the trust. It also allows for generation after generation after generation, which prior to the Alaska Trust Act was not a problem because I believe in this state it was 90 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's no longer that. And so,
under the old Alaskan Trust Act, before we adopted the uniform, or before we vitiated, I guess is a better way to put it, the rule against perpetuities, you had defined beneficiaries within any trust because you had 99 years plus lives or 90 years plus lives in being, and you had to specify who those lives in being were to make the trust valid, or it would have failed in less time than that. So under that act, I know you had to, which you usually did, you picked the youngest grandchild out there that looked healthy, and you named that one as the life in being, and then it would go for the length of that person's life and then go for the additional period following that. But when we wiped out the rule against perpetuities, these things literally would last forever at this point in time. So it may very well have changed, and that may be where Judge Weeks was coming from in his decision.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is, I'd suggest that this is a Senate bill. We've got 1 week left to go. I don't have a problem with 162 or 165 or 166, all additional Senate bills by the committee.
Well, let's put this one aside then.
This one, yeah, I just have remaining concerns about it.
Okay, then let's take up 162. There's a committee CS on it where we, if you look at the draft, senators on page 2, lines 22 through 25 were basically rewritten to be clearer. The original language was somewhat confusing, and the drafter basically rewrote that language. Lines 22 through 25, page 2. The original language had the words, precedent is invalid unless, and then spoke to the power of appointment, which was a repeat of the words, the power of appointment, in the sentence before it. I don't think the structure or the impact of the sentence has changed. I think it's just a little clearer. So, Chair, to entertain a motion to adopt work draft Bannister 51299.
So moved.
Is there objection? There being no objection, the work draft is adopted as a committee CS. Do you have any questions, Senator Donnelly? I don't mean to rush you on this one.
Sure. Maybe the witness could just explain.
Yeah, certainly.
The short version.
Mr. Noy, can you explain that?
I believe Mr. Chappelle is on the line.
Mr. Chappelle, are you on the line? And, no, he's not. Mr. Hoppish is. He's the only one I have listed right
now. Okay, Mr. Hoppish could probably
explain. Mr. Hoppish, could you explain that, please? We're on 162.
Yes, Senator Taylor. My name's, for the record, my name is Rich Hoppish. I'm an attorney in Fairbanks, Alaska, with an office on at 119 North Cushman Street in Fairbanks. And you want me to provide an overview of the entire bill?
No, just an explanation, please, of the changes that were made, page 2, line 22 through 25, on the rewrite of that sentence.
Well, I listened to the House Judiciary Committee a few days ago, and these provisions, lines 22 through 25, and the language appears again in lines on page 3, lines 1 through 3. The language was very confusing because it said a general power of appointment is invalid unless, and it's been changed to clarify that under existing law, powers of appointment that could be created after January 1st, 1996, up until the passage of this bill, and under existing law, we can't go back and change those powers. So this bill says that if you created a power within that window, then old law still applies, which is power is invalid unless paragraphs 1 and 2 below those conditions are satisfied.
And that paragraph primarily is just to take care of that window of opportunity where trust may have been created between the 1st of January and the effective date of this act.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any further questions?
In addition, the changes also appear on page 2, lines 12 and 13. There's a similar change.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I understand those, but I was really asking for just another description of what it does.
Yeah, could you give us a brief overview, Mr. Hoppish?
I think I've got a sense of what it does.
Certainly.
I'd like to hear it.
Still want to hear it.
Yeah, okay.
Go right ahead, Mr. Hoppish.
Okay, Senator Donnelly, under Alaska law before the passage of the Alaska Trust Act, as Senator Teller mentioned, a trust was limited in duration to between life in being plus 21 years, and then it was changed, I think, to 90 years. And the Alaska Trust Act provided that if a trustee could pay the income or principal to a person who was living when the trust was created, that for such a trust, the duration could be forever. And what this bill does is it eliminates that requirement that the income or principal be paid out to a person who's living when the trust is created before the trust can be perpetual. And the reason for it is charitable lead trusts. In a charitable lead trust, the income of the trust is paid to a charity, which is not a person who is alive at the time the trust is being created. It's a, you know, organization, a corporation, a nonprofit corporation. So what this bill does is it eliminates the rule against perpetuities and will allow, in Alaska, a perpetual charitable lead trust.
Mr. Chairman, that was my understanding from the last meeting. I don't feel strongly one way or the other about this. I'm not going to object to moving it. You want a motion to adopt the CS?
We did that. I thought we just did that.
We already did that?
Yep.
Okay.
Just a motion to move the bill with the individual recommendations, though we need at this point. 162.
So moved.
Is there objection? There being no objection, 162 moves. Chair to entertain a motion on 177. Oh, excuse me. Wrong will. 165.
There's one. Could somebody explain this one?
Sure. Mr. Noy?
I guess I defer to Mr. Hoppe's.
Hoppe's again? Okay, Rich, did you hear that one? We're on 165. Could you give us a brief explanation?
Yes, Senator. Let me just take a minute to find it. Oh, yes. What one, Senate Bill 165 provides that creditors of a limited partner or creditors of a member of an LLC have only one remedy when seeking to attach the member or the limited partner's interest in the entity, and that remedy is a charging order. And this is the law, or this was what everyone thought was the law. However, there's been a case under Connecticut that allowed the creditor to foreclose on the member or the limited partner's interest. And what that does is it creates a hardship to the other members of the limited liability company or the limited partnership, because all of a sudden they find out that they have a new partner who in most cases is very detrimental to the business.
What's a charging order?
A charging order is the right to receive all of the distributions that would have otherwise been paid to the member or the limited partner, and those distributions instead are paid to the judgment creditor.
Sounds like an assignment of interest.
Yeah, same thing, I think.
Yes.
And by changing the law in this fashion, the creditor would have the right to do what, Mr. Hoppe?
To receive all of the distributions from the limited liability company or the limited partnership.
But he would not be able to force a sale or liquidation of it, isn't that correct?
Correct. The creditor could not force a sale or liquidation of the business.
And when you say distributions, do you mean just the distributions that would have gone to the person who owed him the money?
Correct.
Not all the distributions, right?
Correct. If for instance, there were four partners and each had a 25% interest, and one of those partners had a creditor with a charging order, 25% of the distributions would be paid to the creditor.
I don't have a problem with this one either.
Okay. Motion?
Move Senate Bill 165 from committee with individual recommendation.
Is there objection? There being no objection, it moves. 166.
Thank you. community property.
Remember last year, I think it was, or 2 years ago, we created in Alaska the right of spouses to enter into a community property definition for their estate or their trust. Because
Alaska could elect to do so. Yeah.
So this is something that people would elect to do as an additional right that they don't currently have in Alaska under common law, or didn't until we passed that law.
So can somebody say what this does?
Yes. You want Mr. Hompish to address that?
Yes, and it's due to a court decision.
Okay, Mr. Hompish, on 166, please.
Senators Taylor and Donnelly, I have to confess, I didn't work on this one. So, unfortunately, Dave Sheffield is the expert, and I'm at a little bit at odds to explain it. I'll need a minute to read it and refresh my memory.
Well, while you're doing that, maybe Mr. Noy could give us some general background on what this one does.
Well, there's, as I understand it, a Wisconsin court decision where the court claimed that the transfer was a gift, as opposed to allowing them the double step-up basis, which is a tax-free exchange. And this verbiage in here is to correct or tweak our law so it has the right terminology in it, so a judge can't come in and claim that the transfer is a gift as opposed to a non-taxable transfer.
What transfer are you talking about?
Well, it's a transfer on death. That's the way it reads. For a surviving spouse's interest.
As I understand, under a community property state, you have a double step up in basis, and that is that when one of the spouses dies, the whole estate is revalued at current market value. In a separate property state, only the decedent's part of the estate is stepped up to current market value, and the surviving spouse stays at whatever the original basis was in the assets of the estate.
Is that under federal tax law?
It's under federal tax law. That's correct.
So
federal tax law is controlled by the state's interpretation of the definition of the property.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what are we trying to do with this bill?
Well, let me give you an example I think will work, and you correct me, Mr. Hompish, you do too if I'm wrong. Mom and Dad own a homestead. Dad dies. Under Alaska law, the way our law applies to the federal tax law, you evaluate Dad's share of the estate at the stepped-up basis, because that's the way it's going to be conveyed. His interest is going to be conveyed to her or to whoever else they designated within. That's the basis they take it at as of the date of his death. Her basis remains the same. She's got the original $2,500 basis that represented her share of the property when they took over the homestead. When she dies, she is then stuck with that same basis.
Right.
But it gets stepped up for those people to whom she conveys it to, right? Okay.
And it's taxable.
And it's taxable based on her basis. What happens is you end up with a second spouse getting nailed for a whole bunch of taxes.
Wait a second. I thought the second spouse has to die before it's a problem because
her estate is going to.
Yeah.
Yeah, her estate will pay significant taxes because she did not. If you have community property and they both get the stepped up basis at the time of the first person's death, then her basis is now, for tax purposes, the same as his was at the point of time of distribution. If she only lives a few more years, you're not going to have a dramatic increase.
Okay, let me take a stab at this. All right, so we got
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Mary Ellen Beardsley with the Department of Law. I'm in Anchorage.
Oh. Chime in, Mary Ellen. We need your help.
it was my understanding that the reason the Community Property Act was passed is that, same example, husband and wife have this homestead, so they have a $5,000 basis in it, each have $2,500 basis then. If they elect to have the property treated as community property, and let's say it's then worth $50,000 later, the spouse, the first spouse that dies, receives a stepped-up basis of the $25,000, but the surviving spouse would not have that stepped-up basis. And then the surviving spouse then sells the homestead. The surviving spouse would have to pay capital gains or substantial taxes on her half of the property, but the other half of the property that received the higher stepped up basis would not be paying any taxes on it. However, if it's community property, she receives an automatic stepped up basis as well. And when they sell the property, there will be no tax involved.
And your hypothetical supposes that they sell the property at no more than the stepped-up basis, though, right?
Well, that's true, but it doesn't really make any difference. Even if they sold it, let's say later on, she sold it, let's say, for $100,000, they still would have a substantially less tax impact than they would have if she hadn't received her stepped-up basis.
But
that was part of the reason why they wanted to have this property treated as community property for tax reasons.
At the time of death of the first spouse under a community property state, the entire estate gets valued. Is that right?
In essence, yes.
Right.
Anything that's been treated as community property,
yes. Anything treated. So the entire estate gets valued as of the date of that first person's death. Upon the second spouse's death, that spouse's basis is now what the basis was when the first spouse died, not what it was when they bought the property 45 years before.
That's correct, except again, that property will get another stepped up basis because of the second party's death.
Right.
Assuming they've held on to the property all this time.
Yeah, okay. Or if she wanted to sell it, she wouldn't be facing a lot of capital gains tax on her half of the estate. Without the change in this law, though, we are still stuck with existing state law, aren't we?
Yes. We are, and well, except we have Community Property Act that has been passed last year, and you can make that election. My understanding with this one is that there were some ramifications from that Wisconsin law or case, and the way I read this is that the surviving spouse can make some kind of can amend the community property agreement as it only pertains to her property she placed into the community property agreement.
Right. Now, I noted that in the last paragraph. It had to be her surviving spouse's property that came in to begin with, so she couldn't go back in and amend a conveyance, whether it's trust or whatever, she couldn't go back and amend that so as to impact and redirect the funds that her husband, say, had left and he had acquired during their marriage.
That's how I read it as well.
Good.
Now, Rich Hompish can step in here at any time because he does estate planning much more than I do.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I agree with what Mary Ellen Beardsley said. I've read the study of the bill here for the last 5 minutes, and what it does is it allows the surviving spouse, as you say, to make changes in the trust or the community property agreement as to her half of community property.
And I think it's being put in and stated that they have to have that ability or else it would be violative of the holding in the tax court back in Wisconsin. I can understand why the IRS would want to put some hoops in there to keep people from being able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions? Chair to entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we Senate Bill 166 move from committee with individual recommendation.
There being no objection, you're just in time.
And, Mr. Chairman, I can only stay a few more minutes to help.
I've got Fred coming up right now.
To pass his bill, and then I've got to go.
Okay, Fred, you're up. House Bill 177 is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for hearing us. Last year, when we, in the last minutes, with you guys' active help, got House Bill 375 passed, Child Protection Act, in the last minute thrash, we, in the bill, we tried to give parents and foster parents, or foster parents, access to the criminal records, behavior records of the kid that they were getting, place at the table and treatment plans, and a voice in court. We got it done for the child in need of aid, the China kids. Inadvertently, we didn't get it done for the delinquent kids. We missed it. I missed it. And so this is just a cleanup.
Is there anything that you don't like about this bill?
No, nor is...
Thank you for your testimony supporting it, Senator.
Thank you, sir.
Senator, have any questions?
No.
It's something we worked on hard last year, Fred, and I really appreciate you bringing it back up for us. Senator Ellis.
I move that House Bill 177 pass out of committee with individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? There being no objection, 177 moves from committee. Thank you all for attending. We're adjourned.